the Big Pond.
One could legitimately say that the Mediterranean was the inland sea of classical civilization. And then it's not a great big intellectual leap to think that the ocean next door, the Atlantic, could fairly be described as the inland sea of modern Western civilization. And that, I think, was the guiding principle with which I approached this book.
That's Simon Winchester. We talked to him about his history of the Atlantic Ocean. It's called Atlantic. And it's the 100th anniversary of the biggest factory fire in the history of the U.S.
The Triangle Waste Company had about 500 workers churning out shirt waists, which were a new fashion, and this was the biggest shirt waste company in the world. And a fire broke out on the 8th floor, and within 15 minutes, at least 146 people had died.
We air our 2007 interview with Catherine Weber about her novel Triangle. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It was known at one time as a sea of perpetual gloom, inhabited by sea monsters and lashed by killer storms. It took the intrepid Phoenicians, who were looking for a particular species of snail, for Western humans to venture into its feared waters. Born 10 million years ago, the Atlantic Ocean, our guest Simon Winchester says, helped define Western civilization. From the Vikings to the great merchant fleets that gave rise to capitalism, the maritime explorers, the pirates, admirals, and whalers who sailed its dark green waters, to the NATO alliance of today. Winchester covers its geologic, economic, and literary history to spin a vast tale of our dependence on this great body of water, and imagine what might happen to it in the future. His book, Atlantic, Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories, is structured around a literary device. Winchester uses Shakespeare's monologue in As You Like It, The Seven Ages of Man, to explore the seven ages of the Atlantic Ocean. Simon Winchester is the author of several bestsellers, including The Professor and the Madman. We talked to him in 2007 about his book about the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, A Crack in the Edge of the World. Well, Simon Winchester, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you.
You started your love affair with this ocean, it seems, as a young man. Can I call it a love affair?
I think so, yes. I mean, I'm completely besotted with the ocean. I grew up beside it in Dorset in southwest England, and I, as you say, first traveled across it in the 1960s when I was a young man. And I think when, as a youngster, one gets on a great big ocean liner and confronts the majesty of a body of water like the Atlantic, you're likely to be affected by it probably for the rest of your life, and indeed I was. And oddly enough, there was a very pleasant coda to that first trip. Just the other day, I was in southern England giving a talk about the book, and a woman came up to me somewhat out of breath, and she said, "I'm so sorry, I wasn't able to come to your talk, but I've been looking for you for the last 25 years, which was somewhat alarming. But she then said, "Don't worry about it. I've just got a simple question. Have you ever been on a ship called the Empress of Britain?" And that happened to be the ship that I was traveling on back in the 1960s. And I said, "Yes, and in fact, I've just been lecturing about it." And she said, "I knew it was you. Have a look at this." And she took out of her handbag a diary, which was titled "Emigrating to Canada!" And she turned to the first page, 30th of April, 1963, and it said, "Was feeling rather sad. We've just left Liverpool, saying goodbye to my old life and beginning a new one. Raining, and but everything seems to be going better because I've just met this young boy called Simon, and he's going to America for a year to hitchhike, and he bought us a bottle of wine for dinner and then played cards with us."
weren't you a wonderful young man then?
Well, I obviously seemed to be a rather rich young man as well. I certainly couldn't do it today.
Oh, that's a lovely story. Now, you give the Atlantic more weight in influencing the modern world than the Pacific. Why is that?
Well, I mean, the Pacific may be very big, but it's, in terms of humankind, it just doesn't have, it's not as steeped in history as, let's say, the Mediterranean and the Atlantic. The existence, of course, of the land bridge, the Bering Straits, meant that most migration went over land rather than over the water. And although you do have, of course, the Polynesian navigations, which are terribly famous, and although you have Captain Cook and you have Magellan, there's relatively little human history, at least when compared to those other two bodies of water. I think if one thinks about it carefully, and I clearly didn't in the 80s because I wrote a book about the Pacific. I was living in Hong Kong at the time, and everyone said, oh, the Pacific is clearly the ocean of the future. And that may well be, but the book didn't perform very well. And I think one of the reasons, I mean, it may be that it was badly written, but one of the reasons, I think, is that there is relatively little human history. And so I started to think about it and realized in fairly short order that one could legitimately say that the Mediterranean was the inland sea of classical civilization. And then it's not a great big intellectual leap to think that the ocean next door, the Atlantic, could fairly be described as the inland sea of modern Western civilization. And that, I think, was the guiding principle with which I approached this book.
In fact, it took quite a long time for the seafarers to venture out of the Mediterranean into the Atlantic. This was a part of your book that really fascinated me, and I've studied the Mediterranean a fair amount, so I know that I lived in Provence for a while and delved into the history of the Greek discovery of Provence and then the Romans coming after that. Tell us about why the Atlantic lay so far beyond the human exploration for so long, and then how that great drought was broken.
Well, all the old classical writers who had glimpsed the Atlantic saw it as being a gray and heaving and storm-filled and probably monster-filled body of water that quite probably marked the edge of the world, that if you went out into it, if you managed not to be sunk or devoured, you'd probably fall off the edge of the planet. And so that was really the mantra that must have been at the back of the minds of all those sailors who were rather carelessly tripping around the Mediterranean, and principally, of course, that would be the Phoenicians, because, yes, although the Greeks indeed did discover Provence, the big trading nations were the little boats that ventured out from ports like Tyre and Sidon on the Levantine coast. And they got all the way through both the north and southern shores of the Mediterranean, and they could see beyond the Pillars of Hercules, beyond the great cliffs of Gibraltar on the right-hand side and the cliffs of what we now know as Morocco on the left-hand side. They could see this mysterious and rather daunting body of water, which they dare not go out into because of what people like Homer had written, the Sea of Perpetual Gloom. And so they didn't until this seminal moment about 7 centuries BC, when some Phoenician boats went out there and went in search of, it sounds almost impossibly mundane, of a snail, a very large snail called Murex brandaris, which the Phoenicians already were harvesting on the shores of North Africa, because when treated in a certain way, the snail inside the shell would emit an indelible and very beautiful purple dye that the Roman and Greek aristocracies liked to color their clothes with. We still have the phrase, born to the purple today. So they made a lot of money out of this murex, and they thought, well, maybe it exists out in this other ocean. And so in their little tiny boats, they did brave it. They decided to go out past Gibraltar into this body of water, and they found that they didn't sink and there were no monsters. They turned left and they turned up eventually a couple of islands off the coast of Africa filled with these shells. And so they settled there, built up a trading post, and from there started their explorations, which would take them further down the coast of Africa and then northwards up the coast of Spain and France and eventually to England. And that was the beginning, 7 centuries BC, of humankind's exploration of this great and hitherto unknown ocean.
And there was a really difficult place along that coast that it took, until the 18th or 17th century, or maybe 16th century, but
well,
a long time.
A little bit earlier than that, the 15th century, actually, to wind you back. But that was what you're thinking of is a cape called Cape Bojador, which is little known today because you sail round it with total equanimity. But in the 15th century, all the navigators that went southwards along the African coast suddenly found that there was this sand spit which stuck out from the coast of what is now southern Morocco into the Atlantic Ocean, and they could not get round it because if they tried to, then the winds suddenly started to become very contrary and the currents started to become dangerous, and they would be overwhelmed and would either have to turn back or they'd be sunk or they'd be becalmed. And it took until the middle of the 15th century when a very brave navigator and a very clever navigator called Gil Eanish, who was sent out by Henry the Navigator, the much more famous Portuguese sailing master, and he divined how to get round this. It's rather complicated discussing how he did it, but he did manage, and once that gateway had been breached, as it were, then suddenly all of the South Atlantic was open for exploration, and that led to people like Vasco da Gama and all the great Portuguese explorers who then went down to South Africa and then round the bulge and into the Indian Ocean and discovered basically the East. And so getting round Cape Bojador, little known though it may be today, was a tremendously important step in Atlantic history.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Simon Winchester. His latest book is a sweeping history and appreciation of the Atlantic Ocean. It's called Atlantic. Now, another thing, you have a kind of a certain structure that you've adopted here, a mechanism that you've used. You've taken from Shakespeare, each chapter or each section of the book really responding to a different aspect of that great poem of the Seven Ages of Man. Tell us about them. Why did you choose that?
Well, the initial structure of the book I decided should be somewhat geological or almost biographical because we know when the ocean was born, which was about 195 million years ago, and we know, or at least we think we know, when it'll cease to be, which is in about 170 million years to come. So, if you like, the overall, the meta structure of the book is that it has a birth and it has a death and it has a life. So there's a sort of biographical framework. But the difficult thing when I was contemplating writing this book is how to deal with the center part, the most important part of the book, which is humankind's relationship. It's about 200,000 years in which mankind has been involved with the ocean. And that's not easily amenable to this biographical structure. So I had to come up with something else. And one day I was crossing the ocean on an aeroplane, and I had, to keep me from getting bored, a copy of an anthology of poetry by a British politician, oddly enough, a chap called David Owen, now called Lord Owen. And he had organized all the poems that he loved in his life according to the Seven Ages of Man from Shakespeare, from As You Like It, All the World's a Stage, and All the Men and Women Merely Players. And if you remember from school, those seven ages are infancy, so the infant, the schoolboy, the schoolchild, the lover, the soldier, the justice, the old man, and return to childhood. And it seemed to me in a flash that everything that I was beginning to learn about the Atlantic Ocean could be corralled into these seven large compartments. So, for instance, everything to do with warfare, with Battle of Trafalgar and the Monitor and the Merrimack and the Battle of Jutland and also slavery and piracy, everything violent, could be put into the heading that Shakespeare had called the lover, the soldier, rather. Whereas everything to do with art and poetry and music and architecture, that could be put into Shakespeare's lover chapter. And that's how I decided to organize the book. And thus far, the critics have been pretty kind, and no one has said, how dare he use Shakespeare? Well, Shakespeare never knew of the Atlantic, he never went on the Atlantic, never went in a ship, and yet unwittingly he provided what I think is the ideal structure for a book as complex as this.
And it is a wonderful structure. But you do say that that you think that Shakespeare cites the tempest in the Atlantic. So how, if he really didn't know about it, how do you make that connection?
Well, it's an interesting connection. What had happened was in the latter part of the 16th century, beginning of the 17th, a man called George Somers, who came from southwest England, oddly enough, where I grew up, and he was sailing a small ship across the ocean to resupply the colony that the British had built in Jamestown in Virginia, arguably one of the first colonies on the American coast. However, he came, there was a terrible storm, and he was dashed ashore on an island which he didn't know existed. And it turned out to be a rather pleasant island, and he was able, had a lot of trees, a lot of cedar trees, and he was able to rebuild his boat, or turn his original boat into two smaller boats, and continued his voyage and eventually got to Jamestown, but then was so tempted by the island that he had stranded on that he turned back, found it again. It was called Somers Island after him. He was George Somers. Eventually, though, it was to be called Bermuda. He died there, but his story of the shipwreck came back to London, and Shakespeare heard it, and in a coffee house in London, and he decided that he would write a story based on a shipwreck. And that story, and there is a line in The Tempest, the play that eventuated, where he talks about the still vexed Bermudes, which is the way that Bermuda used to be referred to. And that is the clue that makes Shakespearean scholars believe that it was Shakespeare hearing of the exploits of George Somers and the discovery of that island that prompted him to use it as the basis for The Tempest.
Hmm. Simon Winchester, your book is Atlantic, Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. And there are a million stories, wonderful stories like that in this book. Talking about stories, you make a distinction. You say there's a very different way of writing about the ocean. We're here talking about fiction writing, Herman Melville and others, on this side of the Atlantic, the Americans, as opposed to the British.
Yes, it's an interesting distinction, and it depends largely on the fact that America herself is as vast as the Atlantic Ocean, and as in the early days was as unknown as the Atlantic. So you have someone like Herman Melville, and I'm speaking to you from the Berkshires in western Massachusetts, where Melville, of course, was based. And to him, the ocean that separated Europe and Massachusetts is certainly vast and unknown and mysterious and majestic, but equally so is the landscape that divides Herman Melville from California, say. I mean, there are vast stretches of completely unknown and probably rather dangerous territory, just as there are vast stretches of completely unknown and rather dangerous sea separating him from Europe. And so there was a different perspective. We in Europe tended to write about the sea as if it was overwhelmingly dangerous and mysterious, whereas American writers had an added perspective. And it's not to say that they regarded the ocean with more equanimity or a greater sense of acceptance, but they could say legitimately, and they did in their writings, well, we've got something just as mysterious on our own doorstep. The only difference is that it is made of land, whereas the Atlantic is made of water. It's a subtle distinction, but you can analyze all the writings that Americans have committed about the ocean, and it is significantly and subtly different from European writings, particularly in the field of poetry, oddly enough.
Could you give an example of that?
Well, if you look at someone like Conrad, for instance, writing about the great storms of the Atlantic, you look about and compare that to a man called Richard Hughes, his writing about, in a book called In Hazard, storms in the Caribbean. The difference is that their Captain McWhirr, who's the captain of the ship that deals with the typhoon in the Caribbean, is much more blasé, if you like, about his storm than the characters in Conrad's writing. Conrad is overwhelmed, whereas Captain McWhirr accepts that it's part of the natural order of things. And this, I think, comes from the distinction, the difference between the two schools of writing, a greater acceptance of what the ocean can do among Americans and a more overwhelming sense of, my God, the ocean is unimaginably terrible, that is found among European writers.
Hmm. And, of course, the Americans, well, I'm not alone in this, but the Americans had a very practical approach to the ocean. And Melville was speaking about the whaling industry. You have, I think, one of the most, for me, tragic stories in the book is the story of cod, the disappearance of the cod stocks on the Newfoundland Grand Banks. Tell us what it used to be like, and then what happened to it.
Well, it used to be said when the Basques were traveling there, when John Cabot was traveling there in the 15th century, when they were making films, when Kipling was writing Captains Courageous, and even when Freddie Bartholomew and Spencer Tracy were starring in the film of Captains Courageous, there was the feeling that there were so many of these enormous silvery fish in the waters off the Grand Banks that you could almost walk from Iceland to Newfoundland on the backs of these fish. You could just pluck them out of the ocean with baskets. But then, come the invention of the factory ship in the 1950s and 1960s, and more ominously, come a series of absolutely appalling decisions made by the Canadian government in the 1980s, basically kowtowing to the politicians in Newfoundland. It was allowed for first foreign ships and then Canadian ships to just fish the devil out of the sea with no regard for the maintenance of sensible stocks of spawning fish. And the result of all of this is that this area that once upon a time had huge numbers of cod now has absolutely none. It's as barren as it were the Sahara Desert. There is just no cod left at all, and it's all due to the incompetence and the venal behavior of Canadian politicians, basically. The obverse, oddly enough, is true in the South Atlantic. I mean, this is a North Atlantic tragedy, but in the South Atlantic, you have another fish, not the cod, but it's got a very ugly name. It's a similarly large fish called the Patagonian toothfish, such an ugly name that it's not given that on restaurant menus. It's called the Chilean sea bass, but it's neither Chilean nor is it a bass, but it does live in the sea, that's true. That was on the road to ruin as well until after the Falklands War. The British government, which essentially supervises most of the fishing in the South Atlantic waters, realized what the Canadians had done and decided they wouldn't do the same thing. And so they now regulate the fishery in the South Atlantic for this Chilean sea bass very well. And so that will survive, whereas the Grand Banks, in terms of cod, is now completely played out. And it is, as you say, one of the most tragic fish stories. But it's one that from which I think we're learning, and so that's therefore not altogether a bad thing.
Do you think there's any hope for reseeding the Grand Banks?
Well, I was in Newfoundland about 2 weeks ago, and there is just the most faint sort of susurrus of optimism. Some people are saying there are indications that spawning cod are returning, and you may get some limited return in the next 20 years or so. But I think the Canadians had a terrible fright, and if it does come back, they are going to manage it with such stupendous care that I think it'll be a very brave man that goes out in a fishing boat and is allowed to fish again. I think they will husband them very carefully if indeed they do come back.
So as you see what's happening to the ocean, I mean, you also talk about many other ways in which there is decay. You know, this is the last part of your book. What are your personal feelings here? You start out with, as a young man, with a great love of the ocean. Now you've written this really wonderful book, Atlantic, Simon Winchester. What are your feelings when you see what's happening to it?
Well, I think we are being shamefully disrespectful to the sea. And it's come about, oddly enough, as it's become easier and easier to cross it. I mean, when I crossed it for the first time, it was not a difficult journey, but it was a memorable journey. I mean, there was storms, there was spume, there were seagulls, there was seasickness. Nowadays, we just get on a plane in London and fly over to New York and take 7 hours, and the sea is just demoted to a sort of inconvenient mass of distance. It's called the pond, although it happens that that word has been employed for the last 200 or 300 years. But essentially, when you talk about crossing the pond, hopping over the pond, that in a sort of semantic sense reminds me, at least, that we're careless, we're insouciant, we're disrespectful of the sea, and we disrespect it in all sorts of ways. We overfish it, we pollute it, we acidify it, we toss mercury into it, we toss radioactive materials into it, and we think it's so big that it'll just dilute it and it'll take care of all our problems. Just throw it in the sea. Well, the sea is fragile. The sea gave us all birth. It gives us all life. It sustains us. It is hugely important. We need to respect and to honor it. And I think if there's any underlying message to this book, and that wasn't my intention when I started it, but I think it's my intention now that it's out there, it is, hold on a minute. This sea is majestic and wonderful and life-sustaining. We owe it our respect, and I think we should return to respecting it and not dismissing it merely as distance.
Simon Winchester, your terrific book is Atlantic, Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Simon Winchester. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from his book, Atlantic. Now, I have something serious to talk to you about. On Sunday, March 20th, I was scheduled to do an interview for this show with Malalai Joya. If you haven't heard of her, she's an Afghan politician, writer, and human rights activist, and a woman of undaunted courage. Elected to the Afghan parliament at the age of 27 in 2005, she's used her position to denounce corruption and the continued hegemony of the warlords in Afghan politics. She's also a leading advocate for women's rights in Afghanistan. Because of her harsh criticism of warlords and fundamentalists, she's been the target of at least 5 assassination attempts, and she lives in hiding, moving from safe house to safe house. I've been reading her powerful autobiography, A Woman Among Warlords, and it is an inspiration. Simply said, Malalai Joya is a hero. She was supposed to be here on book tour now, promoting the paperback edition of her autobiography. Hence my planned interview. But I didn't get to talk with her this past week. That's because she's been denied a visa by the U.S. government. This, in spite of the fact that last year Time magazine named her to its Time 100 list and Foreign Policy magazine called her one of the top 100 global thinkers. But our State Department deems her unworthy to address American audiences because she, quote, lives underground. The American Civil Liberties Union, American Association of University Professors, and Pan American Center sent a letter March 21st to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, expressing concern over the denial of a visa to Malalai Joya. I urge you to join your voice to theirs. I want to bring her voice to you. She's someone you've just got to hear. But there are some things that you can do to help Malalai Joya come to the U.S. Go to writersvoice.net for a link or go to afghanwomensmission.org. Next up, we'll hear my 2007 interview with Catherine Weber about her novel Triangle. It's about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. This week marks the 100th anniversary of that tragic event. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Catherine Webber's 2006 novel, Triangle, is about the disastrous 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City. 146 workers, mostly women and children, died in that blaze right near Washington Square. How do we remember and tell our family stories over time, especially when they intersect with family secrets and historic events? That's something Webber explores in her novel, Triangle. Your book weaves fact and fiction together that's anchored by a historical event, that's the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire that happened in New York in 1911. For those of our listeners who don't know about that fire, tell us what happened.
Well, a few minutes before closing time on a Saturday afternoon, in a sweatshop that occupied the top three floors of a 10-story building, the Triangle Waste Company had about 500 workers churning out shirtwaists, which were a new fashion, and this was the biggest shirtwaist company in the world. They were making about 1 million shirtwaists a year, actually, in more than one location, but this was their big location. And a fire broke out on the eighth floor, and within 15 minutes, at least 146 people had died, just engulfed in those flames, trapped in that fire that was so intense and so fast and with so few choices. About 60 of those who died jumped to their deaths from the ninth floor. And from March 25th, 1911, to September 11th, 2001, there hasn't been another workplace fire of such catastrophic proportion.
You know, my grandmother and great-aunt were both sweatshop workers in the garment industry at that time, and my great-aunt told me that she witnessed that fire. And as a result of that, she joined the Socialist Party.
Yes, I think it politicized a lot of people. I think it strengthened the unions. Probably the single greatest effect immediately was that the unions, it empowered the unions because finally they had the eyes and ears of and sympathy of the world for the plight of these workers. Most of them were women. Most of them were young women speaking Yiddish or Italian. Very few of them had been born in America. These were immigrant workers living the American dream. And people like my grandmother and yours, you know, started with nothing and then and worked their way up to have something and something more. And I think the idea that they were betrayed in a way by the American dream is one of the reasons that fire still resonates for so many people. But another very important witness to that fire was Frances Perkins, who was the first female cabinet member of, you know, a president's cabinet. She was Secretary of Labor, and it changed her life forever. And in some ways, it would not be very difficult to make the case that the Triangle Fire planted the seeds of the New Deal.
She was quite a person.
She was a great lady. She really was a tremendously important figure, I think, in you know, the compassion the government can provide, you know, really the heart of the New Deal and the thinking of the New Deal.
Well, now let's get to your family situation. You dedicate this book to your grandmothers. One of them was Pauline Gottesfeld Kaufmann, who worked at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. Is that right?
Yes, that's my father's mother.
It seems that she is the inspiration in more ways than one, perhaps, for one of the main characters in this book.
Well, both of my grandmothers are really, the spirit of both of them is really present in this novel. But the buttonhole finishing one, Pauline, worked at the Triangle. She'd worked at several sweatshops, and that was her last sweatshop job because she became, it is my impression, she got pregnant with my father and then got married and left the sweatshop. And my father was born in the back of a grocery store in Brooklyn in 1910. So she was gone by then. She did not die in that fire. But I grew up in New York City with a high awareness of the fire, and I knew where the building was, and in fact, I later lived on Waverly Place, two blocks from there. I walked by it all the time. It's now an NYU building on the campus of NYU. I've been in the building. I've been up on the ninth floor. But I grew up always knowing that my grandmother didn't die in that fire, but she could have, although she was not present that day. I don't mean to say she survived the fire. But in another sense, you know, all the those thousands of women who worked in the needle trades in the first decades of the 20th century all over New York City could be said to have survived the fire, because they didn't die that day, but they could have, and the women who did die that day were just like them.
You say you grew up with the awareness of that fire. How so? How did you grow up with that?
I knew that the fire had taken place. I knew it would be as if you grew up knowing that the house where your grandmother lived, you know, had burned to the ground one day when she wasn't there.
And why was that? I mean, did your grandmother talk to you about it?
No, my father did. My father talked about it more. I think he wanted to be sure that as comfortable as we were, that we never forget, you know, where we came from and how recently in family history such comforts weren't something to take for granted. I remember once actually sewing a button on a shirt when I was, I don't know, 11 or 12, and my father came and stood and watched me. He was an odd character, I should say, but he came and stood and watched me, and then he said, "When your grandmother was your age, that's what she had to do. She had to work for a living. That's what she did, you know, all day, every day. You know, she didn't have the luxuries of a childhood." You know, in some ways, the last living survivor of the fire in my novel, she's not based on my grandmother in personality or in event, simply for situation, the sort of young women who worked there in those days. And she's also somewhat inspired by, again, not by the personality or life lived, but by the situation of the true last living survivor of the fire, Rose Friedman, whose death in February of 2001 really inspired me to start focusing on this novel, the idea of being the last survivor to have outlived that fire for 90 years made me wonder, listening to her actually in a number of radio interviews. Public radio had various little sound bites of interviews with her over the years, the anniversaries of the fire. It made me question, what would it be like? What would be your relationship to your story if you told your story and told your story for 90 years? If you were famous all your life because you didn't die on March 25th, 1911. And then thinking about what would put that in motion for a novel, raise the stakes, which is what you always want to do when you're writing a novel. What's at stake? Okay, how do you make it more at stake? What would it be like to tell your story for 90 years if your story contains a lie, if your story contains a secret? And so that's how I began to develop the character for my novel, who has nothing to do with either my grandmother or Rose Friedman other than borrowing their circumstances.
And somewhat of their names.
And yes, my grandmother was Pauline and her sister was Esther, and it was a tribute to those incredibly courageous, hardworking women, to borrow their names.
And I'm speaking with Catherine Weber. She's the author of Triangle, a Novel, and you're also the author of The Piano Lesson.
The Music Lesson.
The Music Lesson.
The Music Lesson, The Little Women, and Objects in Mirror Are Closer Than They Appear are my three previous novels.
I'd like to go back to that point that you just made. What would it be like for somebody who retold their story for 90 years? In this book, not only does the 105-year-old character of, well, we'll say Esther Gottesfeld,
yes,
retell her story throughout those 90 years, but she's in the book. You retell it at least four or five times, maybe even six times. Talk about why did you decide to use that
repetition,
yes, within the book?
Well, it's a musical sort of repetition in the sense that all great music depends on repetition. You wouldn't like music if it had no repetition, if there were no echoes, if there were no themes and variations and iterations of a theme, if it didn't develop from a point with and then return and return again. You know, the final movement of any great work of music is a recapitulation of everything that has come before. And I wanted to write the novel in a very musical way, and there is also a great deal of literal music in the novel, as you know, and that's my other grandmother's spirit. But I also am fascinated by memory and by our relationship to stories and our relationship to stories told over decades. You know, I was quite influenced by Holocaust testimony videotapes, which I have seen, and the way people tell their stories, and you can just see them struggling with a relationship to a story and There's the rote telling, and then there's the really felt, emotionally authentic moment that shifts in the rote telling and then back to the rote telling. And that intrigues me, the question of our agenda when we tell a story, our agenda when we listen to a story, you know, and the shifts that occur over time. I think we all have elderly relatives who can be prompted to tell a story where you just feel the needle dropping into the groove of the familiar story. But then if you are questioning in a certain way or if there's something that's different today, the story is told a little differently. And as someone in the narrative business, that really fascinates me. And that's where the heart of the story really lies for me.
You even mention at one point the name Rashomon.
Rashomon, yes, the Japanese play, which is famously invoked when everyone saw the same thing and no one saw the same thing.
And yet in this story, as you point out, different people who were present at the same historical event will often have a very different telling of it. But in this case, there's another layer. There's the lie there. Could you say something about the relationship between the lie for this character and the retelling of the story?
Yes, I don't want to reveal what the secret is, although I have to say it's interesting to me that so many readers have, some people have felt that they understood what the secret was, you know, within the first few pages, and other people are completely shocked when it occurs to them very late in the novel, and then there are those readers who still don't quite get it even after they've done reading it. I've visited many book groups where people have heated discussions about what they think that was all about. But I'm intrigued by the relationship to the secret more than I am by the secret itself, in the sense that it's not a conventional mystery. It's not Agatha Christie. It's not the butler did it. It's hidden in plain sight. And I'm interested when secrets and lies occur in family histories for good reason, which is to say I'm always most interested as a novelist when people do the right things for the wrong reasons or the wrong things for the right reasons. You know, that's when it gets really interesting. And that's what I hope my readers take away.
And that's certainly something that happens in conditions of crisis.
Yes. You know, listening to those Holocaust testimonies, do we know that they are absolutely the truth in every sense? You know, they're somebody's truth. They're the truth somebody needs to tell for whatever reason. I'm certain that many people did things or witnessed things they would rather not think about or would rather describe another way. And, you know, in the end, maybe you get to own your own story to a certain extent under certain circumstances.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think you know what I mean by that in relation to the story of this novel. The lie that the oldest living survivor of the fire tells and tells and tells, she made a choice in an instant, and then she stuck to her story for 90 years for many good reasons. And I think it's an honorable lie in a certain sense.
So she owns it by right?
Yes, yes, I think so. And I think that there are times when the whole truth and nothing but the truth is not necessarily in anybody's best interest, actually.
And yet there is a character in this novel who is relentlessly pursuing the truth.
And never catches it. I mean, Ruth Zion, the irritating scholar, actually misses the boat. I think she puts it in motion in a certain way, and her inquiry, her mole-like agenda is certainly becomes a little bit of a tug of war for who's going to have control over the story, you know, Esther's granddaughter Rebecca or Ruth Zion. But in the end, Ruth Zion walks out of the story without ever really having got it.
Yeah, and she's a complicated character. Why did you put her in this novel, and why first describe her? And
well, she's meant to be a comical character in a certain way. She's a deadly serious scholar with a very, very blinkered personal agenda. She's sort of self-obsessed and relentless. And she's a type very, very familiar to those of us who have ever spent time in any academic setting. I taught fiction writing at Yale for 8 years. I've taught several other places. These days, I'm a thesis advisor at Columbia. These are familiar characters, people who are very, very territorial and focused on their subject. And the people they most resent are those who simply have natural rights to it as opposed to earned scholarly credentials. But beyond that, she's very much a type. You would meet her at MLA conferences. Humorless, obsessed with her footnotes and her PowerPoint presentations. And so as much as she's really put her heart and soul into her work, she's lacking some essential human connection to it.
And yet she almost seems to be like a character of a certain kind of postmodern feminist. You even, I think, one of the other characters calls her unfulfilled. Why did you make her such a caricature?
I was having fun with her because people like that really, really annoy me. And because I have no problem with a character in a novel seeming like a character in a novel. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because there have been, especially in the world of literary blogging, there have been some people who find her the one character who somehow doesn't seem realistic and seems like a caricature. And I do think she's quite realistic, and I've often had other sorts of people say to me, oh, I can't believe you've never come to my department meetings because I'm certain you're writing about this particular person. So she doesn't seem so unrealistic to some of us. But she is meant to be a bit much, you know, in the Dickensian sense. And there seems to be a movement in contemporary fiction writing and reading, sort of a post-irony phase that I think I've just missed out on as a writer myself.
A post-irony phase?
Yes. I mean, I like irony. I like it a lot. And I feel as if there's this... there's a way of reading Ruth Zion. The Ruth Zions of this world are not going to like the way I wrote Ruth Zion. But she's meant to be a figure of fun. She's meant to be a little bit too much.
And yet... she's a very essential part of the story.
Absolutely.
You know, I had the sense that in some way she's a stand-in for the novelist herself.
Well, I would actually make a distinction there. I want her to be a stand-in for you, the reader, which is to say, as irritating as she might be, I want the reader to have a growing, if guilty, identification with her, because even if she's a little bit insensitive and not really so good with other people and very unself-aware, her heart is in the right place, and you would like to have the answers to the questions she is asking, because she's really her agenda interests us, and I want the reader to want to, you know, to want her to succeed despite her obnoxiousness.
Well, exactly, and I guess I was thinking in a sense, well, you know, as a journalist myself and as someone, I've been researching my own father's history during World War II, mm-hmm. and in Holland, very much involved with the hiding of Jewish refugees there.
How fascinating.
And I've had to penetrate and ask a lot of questions that people find uncomfortable, and I've found secrets. And sometimes
I imagine you have found secrets you weren't looking for at all.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And so I had to think about, okay, whose agenda is this? Is, you know, the truth, as Ruth Zion says, you know, she is going after the truth. The truth is more important than people's feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've had to question myself, well, is that just because I want to know the truth? So what about this relationship between discovery and the secrets that families want to keep?
Well, I think I don't have answers. I just have questions. And I think those are some of the questions that I think are put into play in the novel. Family history, who owns your family history, who owns the story, how do we tell the story? One of the things the novel takes up is the many, many ways the same story can be told. DNA plays an essential role in this novel, and the fact is the way your mother might tell your story isn't necessarily the same way your DNA would tell your story, speaking of family secrets.
And we're talking with Catherine Weber about her novel, Triangle. It's about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and the granddaughter of the oldest living survivor of that fire. Now, going to the theme of DNA and genetics and even music, you draw in these themes in a very interesting manner. We have the character Rebecca, the granddaughter of the last surviving witness to the Shirtwaist Fire. She lost her parents when she was 8 and was in fact raised by her grandmother in the book. And she is a geneticist. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, she is very attached to her grandmother, although she doesn't really know as much about her as she thinks she does, as the story begins. But she's a genetic counselor. Her true love is a musician named George Botkin, and he plays quite an essential role in the story. He writes music based on forms found in nature, and that's actually one of the things that draws them together. Forms found in nature, whether it's tide tables or labor contractions or the molecular structure of echinacea, and then finally DNA, which becomes an essential sort of key that turns the lock in this story. And the novel concludes with the Triangle Oratorio, which is a massive work of music of his, which invokes the fire in its full complexity with the many chorus of the many voices of the people who were there that day. And it's yet another way history is told. You know, if you think of the novel as being composed of many, many artifacts and documents and really suggesting that there are so many possibilities for how we know what we think we know and where history comes from and how it's documented and how we read for information. Music is another form of communication. His music is another way of telling a story, and his music also contains the information of history.
And where did you get the inspiration for the kind of music he creates? I mean, it's very extraordinary, the descriptions of it. His music really has the power, an almost kind of magical power.
It does, and at the same time, he never makes that claim. It's the way people respond to it. But he doesn't claim that his music has the magical powers that other people ascribe to it. I had in mind the Triangle Oratorio with which the novel concludes before I wrote the novel. I had written only that first chapter, the first telling of Esther's survival of the fire, and I had in mind the way the novel would conclude and the way the story would open up and open out and all would be explained more fully through this work of music, really before I wrote anything of the book beyond that. And so it's always been in my thoughts as an essential way of telling the story. And while I was writing this novel, I was also involved in producing a restoration recording of the 1930 Broadway musical with a score that my grandparents wrote, you know, thus the other grandmother, Kay Swift, who wrote Broadway show tunes. And I was very involved in her music at that time, which is nothing like George Botkin's. But my grandmother is best known in musical theater circles, probably not for her own work, which is a shame because her own work is significant, and she wrote Can't We Be Friends and Fine and Dandy and Can This Be Love, and was the first woman to write the score to a Broadway musical, Fine and Dandy, in 1930. But she's best known because of her great big romance with George Gershwin.
Wow.
The 10-year romance. And it is no accident that my composer is named George.
That's wonderful.
Although he is not George Gershwin, not in personality, and his music isn't George's, but I did want to invoke that sense of limitless genius that George Gershwin had.
Now, you know, you have a very funny section in the book, a scene in the book where he has created a work called Parturition, based on the charts of
labor contractions.
Of labor contractions that Rebecca has done for her master's thesis or doctoral thesis. And women in the audience who are close to parturition themselves find that they're getting the labor contractions. They're going into labor.
Yes. And again, you know, it's sort of a toe in the water of magical realism, which is to say something about the way he can transpose those forms into music might flow back to listeners who feel it, who get it. You know, similarly, he has a piece of music based on the molecular structure of echinacea, and, you know, naturopaths think that it helps cure colds, just like echinacea. But again, he isn't making those claims, and he isn't writing this music with an agenda like that. And here, again, I'm bringing in the question of the agenda with which people listen, with the agenda with which we listen to stories or listen to music, for that matter, in this case.
So you're saying that's the thread between music and history.
Absolutely. We get from it what we came to get. You know, similarly, the Triangle Fire itself, there were no books about the fire in the teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. 1962, you have the first significant book by Leon Stein, a wonderful book, still the landmark book. He interviewed so many survivors. And then suddenly in the mid-60s, there's this flourishing industry of books about the Triangle Fire for children. Why? The women's movement. So in this instance, you have the story taken up and told, you know, looked at, gazed at through this new lens of the women's movement, and it becomes a woman's story. And all these books are aimed at girls and teenage girls, more than boys, I would have to say. And those books continue to this day. There are 3, 4, 5 a year being published now. You know, but it didn't begin until the 60s.
And those issues still exist.
Those issues are very much in our thoughts, and perhaps a new way of thinking about the Triangle Fire, the way that I would like people to think about the Triangle Fire, is to think about who made your clothes, where did they come from, and what are the lives of the people who made them. Because these days, we don't have sweatshop fires in this country, hardly ever. We certainly don't lock children into unsafe sweatshops where cheap garments are being produced, where they die in a fire. We outsource. Those garment factories are in Bangladesh and Malaysia and Hong Kong, and that's where the fires are, and that's where the deaths are. And it continues. There are children dying in sweatshop fires now, making cheap goods that we wear without much thought.
Catherine Weber. Her novel Triangle won the 2007 Connecticut Book Award for Fiction. March 25, 2011 marks the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. If you're in the New York area any time between now and the end of May, you can see an exhibition about it at NYU with photographs, archives, artifacts, and film clips. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to more information, as well as a terrific video from the New York Times about garment workers today. You can also find an excerpt from Weber's novel, Triangle. In addition to that book, she's the author of The Music Lesson, 1999, The Little Women, 2003, and True Confections, 2010. She's working on a memoir about family stories and the narrative impulse called The Memory of All That, due out this year. We first aired this interview in 2007. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.